Imagine if today was the day your idea changed someone's life. Imagine if you could help someone pay for college, help your community build a new playground, or help a child make it to that dream competition. With GoFundMe, it's all possible. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 190 million people. Every week, ordinary people meet their goals and do extraordinary things. Your ideas matter. GoFundMe isn't just for emergencies. Want to raise money for your kid's soccer team or raise funds for a small business, a creative project, or event? GoFundMe helps you turn ideas into reality. And help adds up. Fundraisers you start for someone else raise up to 5 times more. So think right now, who could use your help? Change rarely comes from waiting. It comes from someone deciding, today I'll start. Don't wait for someone else to bring change. Today, start your fundraiser in just minutes at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com to start your fundraiser. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, where we unpack the stories behind the headlines and explore the people who shaped our past. Today, we're plunging into a pivotal, almost unfathomable moment in American history.
Right.
Picture this. It's April 1865. The nation has just emerged from 4 years of brutal civil war, reeling from the profound trauma of division and loss, and then a shattering blow. Abraham Lincoln, the leader who guided the Union through its darkest hour, is assassinated.
Just gone.
Suddenly, into that unimaginable void steps a man from Tennessee, a figure few truly understood, thrust into the presidency at the most critical juncture imaginable.
It's hard to even grasp the shock. What does this mean? For the country, for reunification, for freedom?
Exactly. What does this mean for a country teetering on the edge of a new era, grappling with freedom and the very definition of unity?
It's a moment that feels less like history and more like high drama, isn't it? The country is in deep shock, needing a steady, unifying hand. And instead, it gets Andrew Johnson, a man about whom almost everyone had reservations, but, you know, for very different reasons.
And that, for you, is our deep dive today. The extraordinary and deeply controversial life of Andrew Johnson, the 17th president of the United States.
Yeah.
You've provided us with a truly fascinating collection of sources, and our mission is to unpack the story of a man who, against all odds, rose from abject poverty to the highest office, only to face an impeachment trial and leave a legacy that historians still hotly debate.
And it is hotly debated.
We'll explore the surprising facts that shaped him, his pivotal and at times, well, calamitous, role in a defining moment of American history reconstruction, and just enough illuminating insight to help you become truly well-informed without feeling overwhelmed by the sheer volume of information.
What becomes immediately clear when you look at Johnson is that his story is a tapestry woven with incredible contradictions. I mean, think about it.
Right.
He was a Southern Unionist who, perhaps ironically to modern ears, owned slaves.
Which is a huge point right there.
A huge point. He passionately championed the plebeian or working class, only to become president after Lincoln and clash dramatically with the very Congress elected by the people.
And then, in a twist that's almost unbelievable, he remains the only former president in American history to ever return to serve in the Senate.
It's just wild.
Uh-huh.
His life is packed with these unexpected turns and an almost infuriating stubborn determination that, as we'll see, set the stage for epic clashes that still reverberate today.
Okay, let's unpack this journey right from the very beginning.
Cool.
To truly grasp Andrew Johnson, we absolutely have to start at his roots, which were about as humble as they come. He was born on December 29th, 1808, in Raleigh, North Carolina, into profound poverty.
And not just regular poor, we're talking abject poverty.
Right. His birthplace wasn't some grand estate, but a simple two-room shack, a detail he would famously and often invoke throughout his political career as a powerful testament to his self-made image, a direct appeal to the common man.
His parents, Jacob Johnson and Mary Polly McDonough, were both illiterate tavern servants. His father, Jacob, also held a variety of other low-wage roles, town constable, bank porter. But their financial situation was undeniably stark, living, you know, hand to mouth.
And tragedy struck very early in his life. Jacob died when Andrew was just 3 years old.
Yeah, just three.
It wasn't a quiet passing either. His father suffered an apparent heart attack after heroically rescuing three drowning men. This left his mother, Polly Johnson, to become a washerwoman, a truly stigmatized occupation at the time, making her the sole struggling support of her young family.
Which meant Andrew himself never had the chance to attend school, which tells you everything you need to know about the family's precarious circumstances. Zero formal schooling.
Yet this lack of formal schooling didn't mean a lack of learning for Andrew. At age 10, he was apprenticed as a tailor to a man named James Selby, legally bound to serve until he was 21.
A long time. And during this period, he learned rudimentary literacy skills from another employee in the shop. But what's particularly insightful about this time, and often overlooked, is how citizens would frequently come to Selby's shop to read aloud to the tailors as they worked.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, this practice, as biographer Annette Gordon Reed suggests, not only instilled in Johnson a lifelong love of learning and political discourse, but also subtly taught him the art of public speaking and argumentation as he meticulously threaded needles and cut cloth. He was absorbing the rhythm of rhetoric while mastering a trade.
It's such a powerful image, isn't it? Learning the very foundations of political debate while his hands were busy with a needle and thread. But despite this intellectual stimulation, his apprenticeship wasn't, well, it wasn't a happy one.
No, definitely not.
After about 5 years, he and his brother William ran away. James Selby was so determined to get Andrew back that he offered a reward specifically noting Andrew Johnson alone, highlighting Andrew's value, perhaps even as a runaway.
Right, suggests maybe he saw something in him even then.
He worked as a tailor in Carthage, North Carolina, and Lawrence, South Carolina, even attempting to buy out his apprenticeship when he briefly returned to Raleigh. Unable to come to terms with Selby and facing the ongoing risk of apprehension, he made the pivotal decision to move west, traveling mostly on foot, seeking a fresh start and, well, a fortune of his own.
This westward journey led him to Greenville, Tennessee, a town he instantly fell in love with and where he truly began to build his new life. He settled there, establishing a successful tailoring business.
And he was proud of his work, too.
Oh, incredibly proud. He famously boasted, "My work never ripped or gave way," reflecting the meticulousness, quality, and immense pride he brought to his craft, a trait that would later characterize his stubborn political resolve. He prospered financially, even investing profitably in real estate, eventually purchasing the very land where he had first camped.
And a truly crucial part of his early success, both personally and politically, came from his marriage in 1827 to 16-year-old Eliza McCardle.
She was so young.
16, yeah. Despite her own struggles with tuberculosis throughout her life, Eliza was absolutely instrumental in his self-education, teaching him mathematics and diligently tutoring him to improve his writing skills.
Which he desperately needed. Having no formal schooling, she was key. But she was a shy, retiring figure, often remaining in Greenville during his political rise, leaving their strong-willed daughter, Martha, to frequently serve as the official hostess during his presidency, partly due to Eliza's ill health.
It was this combination of financial prosperity, his voracious reading of orators, and his engagement in local intellectual life that really sparked his interest in politics.
Right. He'd engage in private debates with customers, right there in his shop. Kind of an early form of political campaigning, perhaps, and also participated in formal debates at Greenville College.
So he's honing his skills.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This naturally led him into public service. He helped organize the mechanics, working men's ticket, in the 1829 Greenville municipal election and was elected town alderman. By 1834, his fellow aldermen elected him mayor of Greenville.
Looking at this early political trajectory, it highlights how profoundly his plebeian background and his experiences as a tailor informed his earliest political endeavors, leading him to consistently advocate for the common working man, for the tradesmen like himself.
It wasn't just representing them. He was them. It wasn't an act.
It sounds like that early experience wasn't just foundational, but almost forged his entire political identity. He wasn't merely a man of the people. He embodied the people he claimed to represent.
Absolutely.
From Greenville, Johnson began his rapid ascent through state and federal ranks. In 1835, he was elected to the Tennessee House of Representatives, where he quickly gained a reputation for being formidable, having apparently demolished the opposition in debate with his powerful, self-taught oratory.
He could really speak. He briefly lost a re-election bid to a Whig, but then, demonstrating his political acumen, he successfully won as a Democrat in 1839. And from that point forward, he didn't lose another race for an astonishing 3 decades.
30 years. That's incredible.
Yeah. He was known for his commanding public speaking, which genuinely drew crowds, and he even attained the rank of colonel in the Tennessee militia, a title by which he was often addressed, adding to his public persona, Colonel Johnson.
It's crucial to note here, though, for a full understanding of his complex character, that despite his humble beginnings and his later fervent unionism, Johnson was, in fact, a slave owner.
Yes, sir.
This is something we absolutely have to grapple with. In 1843, he purchased his first slave, Dolly, who was just 14 years old.
14.
By 1860, his household included 14 enslaved people. However, a truly remarkable detail in his personal history is the story of his former slave, Sam Johnson.
Okay, tell us about Sam.
After emancipation, Sam remained with Johnson as a paid servant and later became a commissioner of the Freedmen's Bureau, the federal agency established to aid formerly enslaved people. And Sam Johnson then successfully negotiated for both land and monetary compensation from Andrew Johnson himself in 1867.
Wow. From his former enslaver, now the president.
Exactly.
This specific interaction with Sam tells us a great deal about the complex, often contradictory relationships that could exist, revealing a fascinating tension between personal action and public policy, especially for someone championing the common man.
That's a truly illuminating detail in a life full of them, hinting at the deep complexities of the era. In 1843, Johnson then moved on to the U.S. House of Representatives, serving an impressive 5 2-year terms.
10 years in the House.
Here, he continued to be a strong advocate for the poor, maintaining an unyielding anti-abolitionist stance, and consistently opposing protective tariffs and extensive government spending, aligning with his Jacksonian democratic principles.
And this is where he pushes his pet project.
Right. It was during this time that he first introduced his brainchild, the Homestead Bill, a revolutionary measure to grant 160 acres of public land to settlers willing to work the land, a proposal deeply important to him, given his own background of struggling for opportunity and land ownership.
You can see the direct link to his own life there. The bill passed the House in 1852, but faced resistance and failed in the Senate. He once lamented, "I have no political future," after a Whig-led Henrymandering, like gerrymandering, redrew his district to be unwinnable for him.
He thought he was done for.
Pretty much. But despite that prediction of a truncated career, he went on to serve as governor of Tennessee, elected twice from 1853 to 1857.
So much for no political future.
Right. Though the office itself had limited constitutional power, Johnson effectively used it as a bully pulpit, a platform to aggressively advocate for his agenda and shape public opinion. During his tenure, he initiated significant reforms, including founding the state's public library, establishing its first public school system, and initiating state fairs to benefit craftsmen and farmers, always keeping his plebeian base in mind.
Even with limited power, he found ways to push his agenda.
Yes. This capacity to operate within limited governmental power while still using the office to push for public good is quite fascinating, demonstrating his persistent drive for popular improvements, especially for those he believed represented the true heart of America.
And from the governor's mansion, he was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1857 by the state legislature. He continued his relentless advocacy for the Homestead Bill, which, after years of his persistent efforts, finally passed in 1862, albeit after his departure from the Senate.
He wasn't even there to see it pass, but it was his baby.
This landmark legislation is widely credited with opening the Western U.S. to settlement, transforming the American landscape. This relentless pursuit over many years really highlights his deep personal conviction tied to his own experience and a willingness to play the long game in politics.
Yeah, that stubbornness, which would later be his undoing in many ways, initially served him remarkably well in these legislative fights for his core beliefs.
As the nation hurtled inexorably towards civil war, Andrew Johnson found himself in an increasingly precarious position. A Southern politician and slave owner who, paradoxically, remained fiercely loyal to the Union.
A very, very tight spot to be in. Following John Brown's raid in 1859, tensions over slavery intensified dramatically across the country. Johnson, despite being a slaveholder himself, delivered a major Senate speech in December 1859, decrying Northerners who sought to outlaw slavery.
And in that speech, he infamously asserted that the phrase, "all men are created equal" from the Declaration of Independence, did not, in his view, apply to African Americans, even citing the Illinois Constitution, which barred voting by African Americans to support his point.
It's a stark, uncomfortable reminder of the deep-seated prejudices that existed even among those who would ultimately fight to preserve the Union. He had even hoped to be a compromise presidential candidate in 1860, positioning himself as a moderate.
Didn't work out.
No. The Democratic Party fractured irrevocably over the slavery question, ultimately leading to Lincoln's election, which in turn spurred widespread talk and then action of secession across the South.
But when his state of Tennessee and others began to secede, Johnson stood absolutely firm. He famously declared with an almost prophetic tone, "I will not give up this government. No, I intend to stand by it, and I invite every man who is a patriot to rally around the altar of our common country and swear by our God and all that is sacred and holy that the Constitution shall be saved and the Union preserved."
Powerful words. He even argued in a desperate plea that if Southern senators would simply hold to their seats, the Democrats could still control the Senate and effectively defend Southern interests against any perceived infringement by Lincoln's incoming administration.
It was a political argument trying to keep them in.
Exactly. But this unwavering loyalty came at an incredibly high personal cost, and it's a testament to his deeply ingrained convictions. Despite threats on his life and actual physical assaults, he campaigned tirelessly against secession in Tennessee, sometimes even speaking with a gun conspicuously placed on the lectern before him.
Wow, a gun on the lectern.
Yeah, a grim symbol of the dangers he faced. When Tennessee ultimately joined the Confederacy in June 1861, Johnson, believing he would be killed if he stayed, fled through the Cumberland Gap, where his party was actually shot at by Confederate sympathizers. He had to leave his wife and family behind in Greenville.
Just fled for his life, leaving his family. That's commitment.
It really is. A testament to the acute danger and his profound commitment to the Union cause.
His commitment to the Union, even as a Southerner, was undeniable and singular. And because he was the only sitting senator from a seceded state to remain in the Union, he naturally had Lincoln's ear in the early months of the war, a unique and powerful position.
Lincoln needed allies like him.
This led directly to Lincoln appointing him military governor of Tennessee in March 1862 with the rank of brigadier general after much of the state had been retaken by Union forces. It was a role that suited his forceful personality perfectly.
But in a cruel and deeply personal twist, the Confederates retaliated swiftly. They confiscated his land and his slaves, even going so far as to turn his home into a military hospital, a profound symbol of the war's intrusion into his personal life.
So while he's governing, his own home is occupied territory.
Exactly. As military governor, Johnson was relentless in seeking to eliminate rebel influence in the state. He demanded loyalty oaths from public officials, shut down Confederate newspapers, and bravely and effectively defended Nashville against General Nathan Bedford Forrest's daring cavalry raids.
He wasn't messing around.
Not at all. And his stance on slavery, deeply rooted as it was, also underwent a noticeable evolution during this period of intense national upheaval. When Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in January 1863, Johnson, rather surprisingly, requested that Tennessee be exempted, and it was.
Still holding on there.
Initially, yes. However, he eventually came to a stark, pragmatic conclusion, stating that if the institution of slavery seeks to overthrow it, the government, then the government has a clear right to destroy it.
So slavery becomes the enemy of the government he's trying to save.
Precisely. He somewhat reluctantly but decisively came to support efforts to enlist former slaves into the Union Army, ultimately succeeding in recruiting 20,000 black soldiers to serve the Union cause in Tennessee.
That's a significant number.
It is. This shifting, pragmatic stance on slavery, coupled with his proven loyalty as a Southern Democrat, paved the way for his next truly unexpected role. In 1864, as Lincoln sought re-election, he made a strategic choice to replace his Republican vice president, Hannibal Hamlin, with a war Democrat on his ticket.
A unity ticket.
Exactly. The goal was to foster national unity and send a powerful message about the folly of secession. Johnson, with his background as a Southern Unionist who had served as a successful military governor, became the logical, even ideal choice to symbolize the continuing capacity for union within the country.
So Lincoln ran under the banner of the National Union Party, a wartime coalition, not strictly Republican, and Johnson was nominated for vice president on the second ballot at the convention. Lincoln, upon hearing the news, is famously reported to have simply remarked, "Andy Johnson, I think, is a good man."
A rather understated endorsement, wasn't it?
Yeah, for such a crucial political move. Johnson actively campaigned, which was unusual for a national candidate at the time, delivering speeches across several states. He also controversially sought to boost his chances in Tennessee by making the loyalty oath there far more restrictive, effectively disenfranchising supporters of the Democratic presidential candidate, George McClellan.
A bit of political maneuvering there.
Lincoln, in his pursuit of national unity, did not intervene, and their ticket successfully won Tennessee.
Then came the infamous inauguration on March 4th, 1865, a moment that would haunt his public image. Jonathan may have been genuinely ill, though historians continue to debate the exact nature of his condition.
Right. There's debate, but the outcome.
The outcome is undeniable. After drinking heavily the night before and on the morning of the ceremony, he delivered a rambling, almost incoherent address in the Senate chamber before a mortified Lincoln and other dignitaries.
Oh, man. Just a disaster.
Total disaster. The spectacle led to widespread public ridicule, though Lincoln, ever charitable, later defended him, stating Andy ate a drunkard. But this public debacle wasn't just an embarrassment. It fundamentally crippled his ability to command respect from Congress and the public, creating a trust deficit that defined his entire presidency even before he officially took office just weeks later.
It must have been devastating to his standing. And that sudden accession, of course, arrived just over a month later. On April 14, 1865, Abraham Lincoln was shot by John Wilkes Booth at Ford's Theater.
And Johnson himself was also targeted by Booth's co-conspirators. His would-be assassin, George Atzerodt, was assigned to kill Johnson, but got drunk and failed to attack him, lost his nerve.
Incredible. So he escapes assassination by chance.
Pretty much. Johnson rushed to Lincoln's deathbed, famously vowing, with a chilling intensity, "They shall suffer for this. They shall suffer for this."
Following Lincoln's death on April 15, Johnson was swiftly sworn in as president by Chief Justice Salmon P. Chase in a small, somber ceremony. Newspapers of the day described his demeanor as solemn and dignified.
A necessary contrast.
A stark and much-needed contrast to his recent inaugural behavior. He immediately asked all of Lincoln's cabinet members to remain in their positions, seeking continuity amidst chaos.
And initially, he took a surprisingly tough stance on the defeated South. He rejected General Sherman's lenient armistice agreement with Confederate General Joseph E. Johnston, an agreement that would have respected slave property.
He wanted unconditional surrender.
Right. Johnson and his cabinet were adamant that Sherman needed to secure a military surrender without making political deals. He also placed a significant $100,000 bounty on Jefferson Davis, who was then a fugitive, giving him the reputation of a man who would be hard on the South.
Which must have surprised some people.
Absolutely. More controversially, he permitted the execution of Mary Surratt for her role in Lincoln's assassination, an act that sparked considerable debate. What's truly fascinating here is how quickly public perception and Johnson's own approach would shift from this initial, seemingly punitive stance, setting the stage for one of the most tumultuous and historically significant presidencies in American history.
As the dust settled from the assassination and the final throes of the Civil War, the nation immediately pivoted to the monumental and deeply complex task of Reconstruction. Upon taking office, Andrew Johnson had a very clear vision for how this process should unfold.
And it was his vision.
And it fundamentally clashed with the prevailing sentiment in the North, particularly within Congress. His primary goal was the speedy restoration of the seceded states, asserting that they had never truly left the Union and should therefore be quickly recognized once loyal citizens formed new governments with minimal federal intervention.
His approach to suffrage was, as you might expect given his earlier remarks, a major point of contention. Johnson firmly believed that African American suffrage was a state, not a federal, responsibility, vehemently opposing any federal mandate.
He saw it as getting in the way.
Yeah, he viewed it as a delay and a distraction to the more immediate goal of reunification and expressed fears, whether genuine or politically convenient, that freedmen, still economically bound to their former masters, would simply vote at their direction, undermining true independence.
In Johnson's mind, Reconstruction wasn't just about restoring the Union. It was also intrinsically linked to shifting political power in the southern states. He aimed to dramatically empower his favored plebeians, the small farmers, the self-employed tradesmen, the yeoman class, at the expense of the old planter aristocracy that he had long resented.
That class resentment ran deep. And let's not overlook Johnson's personal political ambition. He desperately sought to win the 1868 election in his own right, a feat no successor president had managed. And he believed he could achieve this by building a powerful, democratic, anti-congressional Reconstruction coalition in the South.
So personal ambition was definitely part of the mix.
Oh, absolutely. These presidential aims, however, were in direct competition with various Republican visions, which themselves were certainly not monolithic. The radical Republicans, for example, were driven by a profound desire for comprehensive voting and civil rights for African Americans.
I wanted real change.
Real fundamental change. They fervently believed that black votes would not only secure Republican power in the South, but also ensure that top Confederates were genuinely punished for their rebellion, seeing justice and political power as intertwined.
On the other hand, the moderate Republicans had somewhat different priorities. often treading a middle ground. They aimed primarily to keep Democrats out of national power and prevent former rebels from quickly resuming political influence.
Right. Less about radical equality, more about control.
While they wanted to see African Americans treated fairly and afforded basic protections, they were generally less enthusiastic about universal black suffrage, either due to their own local political concerns, sometimes fueled by racial anxieties, or a belief that freedmen might vote badly or be easily manipulated.
And then you had the Northern Democrats, who largely favored the unconditional swift restoration of Southern states and unequivocally opposed African American suffrage, which they saw as a threat to their traditional control in the South and a violation of states' rights.
So a really fractured political landscape.
Totally fractured. With Congress in recess until December 1865, Johnson seized the initiative, left to devise a Reconstruction policy unilaterally. He launched what became known as Presidential Reconstruction. On May 29, 1865, he issued two crucial proclamations.
Hey, what did they do?
One recognized the existing loyalist government in Virginia, and the second provided a broad amnesty for most ex-rebels. With a notable exception for those holding property valued at $20,000 or more, a clear jab at the wealthy planter class he despised.
So targeting his old enemies.
Exactly. He also authorized elections in other former rebel states without making any provisions whatsoever for black suffrage or the protection of freedmen's rights.
The South, feeling emboldened by Johnson's lenient approach and seeing it as an opportunity to regain lost ground, began to form new governments and, shockingly, defiantly returned many of their old Confederate leaders, including former Confederate Vice President Alexander Stephens, to positions of power in Washington.
Just walking right back in. More critically, they passed the notorious Black Codes, a series of highly restrictive laws designed to control the labor and behavior of newly freed African Americans.
These were really awful, weren't they?
Terrible. These codes bound laborers to annual contracts they could not quit, allowed for their arrest for vagrancy, and generally imposed severe limitations on their freedom, essentially placing freedmen in a position barely above slavery. It was a brazen attempt to restore a semblance of the old order.
This Southern defiance, particularly the election of unrepentant Confederate leaders and the egregious Black Codes, proved to be a critical miscalculation by both Johnson and the South. When Congress finally convened in December 1865, Northerners, who had just fought a brutal war to end slavery and preserve the Union, were absolutely outraged.
You can imagine, they were furious. As a result, Congress immediately refused to seat the Southern legislators, effectively nullifying Johnson's presidential reconstruction.
Which really raises the question, did Johnson truly misjudge Northern sentiment and the political determination of Congress to ensure that the immense sacrifices of the war had not been in vain?
It seems so. His actions seem to have inadvertently solidified Republican opposition against him rather than uniting the country as he had hoped. A massive misread.
He absolutely misjudged the mood and the political will of Congress. The year 1866 marked a decisive, irrevocable break between Johnson and the Republicans, setting the stage for his eventual impeachment.
Things really went downhill fast in 66.
Illinois Senator Lyman Trumbull, a moderate Republican leader, had genuinely attempted to work with Johnson, skillfully ushering through Congress a bill to extend the Freedmen's Bureau and the first civil rights bill designed to grant citizenship to freedmen. But Johnson
vetoed them,
steadfast in his belief that these were unconstitutional infringements on state sovereignty and hoping to isolate the radicals in Congress, he surprisingly vetoed the Freedmen's Bureau bill in February 1866. This move, far from just isolating the radicals, delighted white Southerners, but genuinely puzzled and angered many Republicans, even moderates who had been inclined to support him.
And then came the infamous Washington's birthday speech on February 22, 1866.
Oh, the speech.
Yeah. It was an impromptu, hour-long address to supporters gathered outside the White House, during which Johnson, with remarkable self-absorption, referred to himself over 200 times.
200 times?
Over 200. Far more damagingly, in this unscripted tirade, he publicly attacked prominent Republican leaders like Congressman Thaddeus Stevens and Senator Charles Sumner, accusing them, incredibly, of plotting his assassination.
Accusing members of Congress of plotting to kill him.
Yes. Republicans immediately viewed this as nothing less than a declaration of war against Congress, and one Democratic ally candidly estimated that Johnson's ill-advised speech alone cost the party 200,000 votes in the upcoming midterm elections. The political damage was catastrophic.
That speech wasn't just a political disaster, it was a self-inflicted wound of epic proportions, and it was swiftly followed by another pivotal moment. His veto of the Civil Rights Act of 1866 on March 27th.
Another veto.
Johnson objected to the bill primarily because it conferred citizenship on freedmen when, in his view, 11 Southern states were unrepresented in Congress, and he disingenuously claimed it discriminated in favor of African Americans. But within 3 weeks, demonstrating their newfound resolve and power, Congress overrode his veto.
Huge moment.
A truly historic moment, as it was the first time this had ever happened on a major bill in American history. This act is widely considered the most disastrous miscalculation of his political career, finally convincing even moderate Republicans that there was simply no hope of working constructively with him.
The bridge was burned. The chasm between Johnson and Congress widened further still with the proposal of the 14th Amendment. This amendment, which Johnson vehemently opposed, was specifically designed to enshrine the key provisions of the Civil Rights Act into the Constitution, making them immune to future presidential vetoes or Southern legislative action.
Making it permanent.
Exactly. It extended citizenship to nearly everyone born or naturalized in the U.S., except Native Americans.
Right.
Penalized states that denied votes to freedmen, created new federal civil rights protections, and disqualified many former Confederates from holding federal or state office.
And in a significant embarrassment to Johnson.
Yeah, his home state of Tennessee, despite his opposition, was the first Southern state to ratify the amendment, and Congress immediately ceded its delegation, further highlighting his isolation and the growing ineffectiveness of his policies.
Ouch.
His attempt to rally public support for his policies proved to be the final nail in the coffin of his presidential reconstruction. His national speaking tour, derisively dubbed the Swing Around the Circle by critics, was meant to garner public backing, but proved utterly disastrous.
Oh, the Swing Around the Circle, it was bad.
Johnson made controversial comparisons between himself and Jesus, engaged in heated arguments with hecklers from the audience, and delivered rambling, undignified speeches, actions that were widely deemed beneath the dignity of the presidency.
Just cringeworthy stuff. The tour backfired spectacularly, solidifying public opinion against him. The Republicans won the 1866 midterm elections in an absolute landslide, securing a supermajority, well over a two-thirds majority, in both houses of Congress.
Which meant they could override any veto he threw at them. Precisely. This gave them unassailable control of the direction of Reconstruction, completely sidelining the president. He was basically powerless against Congress now.
With the Republicans holding a commanding two-thirds majority after the 1866 elections, radical Reconstruction truly took hold in 1867, ushering in a period of intense legislative action and a direct, unprecedented confrontation with the president.
Congress wasn't holding back anymore.
On March 7, 1867, Congress passed the first Reconstruction Act, decisively overriding Johnson's veto. This landmark legislation fundamentally reshaped the South. It dissolved the existing Johnson-backed Southern state governments, divided the former Confederacy into five distinct military districts, each under martial law and led by a Union general.
Martial law in the South.
Crucially, it established processes for new constitutional conventions, where African Americans were explicitly permitted to vote and serve as delegates, while many former Confederates were explicitly prohibited from doing so. Restoration to the Union was now firmly conditional on the state's ratification of the 14th Amendment and the establishment of Republican governments that protected civil rights.
So, Congress is dictating the terms, completely bypassing Johnson. Passed the very same day, also over Johnson's veto, was the Tenure of Office Act.
Ah, the Tenure of Office Act. This becomes key.
Absolutely central. This controversial bill stipulated that Senate approval was required for the firing of any cabinet members who had been appointed with Senate consent and for 1 month afterward. Its constitutionality was immediately questioned, particularly its applicability to Johnson's cabinet, many of whom were Lincoln holdovers who hadn't been initially appointed by Johnson himself.
So was it even legal? Did it apply to Lincoln's guys?
That was the million-dollar question. This is where the stage was truly and dramatically set for the ultimate showdown between the executive and legislative branches, a battle over the very balance of power in American government.
And the focal point of that showdown was none other than Secretary of War Edwin Stanton.
Stanton, a complicated figure.
Stanton, a Lincoln appointee, was an incredibly able and hardworking man, but notoriously difficult to deal with, highly opinionated and often abrasive. He, along with the General Ulysses S. Grant, actively worked to undermine Johnson's Southern policy from within his own administration, essentially acting as an agent of Congress inside the cabinet.
A spy in the cabinet, basically.
Yeah.
Johnson himself had a very contentious relationship with Stanton, admitting he both admired his capabilities and was utterly exasperated by his insubordination.
You can imagine the tension. Stanton, for his part, refused to resign despite his public disagreements with Johnson and the clear rift between them.
He dug his heels in. He feared that the president would appoint a successor who would reverse the Reconstruction policies he and Congress supported, effectively undoing all their legislative efforts.
So he saw himself as holding the line.
Right. In August 1867, Johnson, determined to remove this thorn from his side, demanded Stanton's resignation. When Stanton defiantly refused, Johnson then suspended him, as permitted by the Tenure of Office Act for congressional recesses, and appointed General Ulysses S. Grant as a temporary replacement while Congress was out of session, hoping to resolve the issue more permanently.
Trying to use a loophole, maybe? But this temporary arrangement quickly dissolved and led to even greater conflict. In January 1868, the Senate, upon reconvening, disapproved Johnson's suspension of Stanton and formally reinstated him, contending that Johnson had violated the Tenure of Office Act by effectively trying to sideline him.
And Grant. He steps aside.
Grant, rather than defying the Senate's decision and over Johnson's explicit objection to the decision, stepped aside, allowing Stanton to return to his office. This led to a complete break between Johnson and Grant, the popular war hero, a crucial political defection for the president.
Losing Grant was huge. This sequence of events set the stage for impeachment. Johnson, now feeling completely defiant and cornered, took the drastic step of directly dismissing Stanton once again, outright, and appointed Major General Lorenzo Thomas to replace him.
He just doubles down.
Completely. Stanton, however, refused to leave his office, effectively barricading himself inside the War Department, turning it into a dramatic standoff.
Stanton locks himself in his office. Seriously.
Yes. On February 24th, 1868, the House of Representatives, seizing on this clear challenge to their authority, voted 128-47 to impeach Johnson, primarily for intentionally violating the Tenure of Office Act and for questioning the legitimacy of Congress itself through his fiery rhetoric.
So impeachment it is.
11 articles of impeachment were ultimately adopted, leading to the first presidential impeachment trial in American history.
The Senate trial began on March 5, 1868, and lasted for an unprecedented almost 3 months, gripping the nation. Chief Justice Salmon P. Chase presided over the proceedings, turning the Senate chamber into a courtroom.
High drama. Johnson's defense argued that the Tenure of Office Act didn't actually apply to Lincoln's appointees like Stanton, as they weren't his appointments, and that the president had the inherent right, indeed the duty, to test a law's constitutionality if he believed it infringed upon executive power.
A constitutional argument versus a political one.
Pretty much. At his counsel's insistence, Johnson himself remained silent throughout the proceedings, relying entirely on his legal team.
Johnson, however, was far from inactive behind the scenes. He actively maneuvered to gain an acquittal, engaging in political horse trading. He reportedly pledged to some moderate senators that he would cease to interfere with congressional reconstruction policies, and even promised to appoint the respected general John Schofield as his new war secretary, a move designed to appease concerns.
So making deals to save his skin. A crucial factor in his favor was also the widespread unpopularity of his potential successor, Radical Republican Senator Benjamin Wade, who, as president pro tempore of the Senate, was next in line for the presidency.
The Wade factor.
Exactly. Wade was seen as far too radical by many, and his ascension would have significantly complicated General Grant's own presidential ambitions, creating a powerful incentive for some to vote against conviction. Politics make strange bedfellows.
And it all came down to a single nail-biting vote. On May 16, the Senate voted on the 11th article of impeachment, considered the strongest charge. The result was 35 guilty to 19 not guilty.
What?
Precisely one vote short of the two-thirds majority required for conviction. Seven Republican senators crossed party lines to vote for acquittal, often facing severe political consequences for doing so.
Career suicide for some of them. Subsequent votes on other articles yielded identical results, and Johnson's opponents ultimately dismissed proceedings. What's truly fascinating here is just how incredibly close the outcome was and the profound implications it had for the separation of powers.
Yeah, it really solidified the idea that impeachment should be for grave offenses, not merely political disagreement or policy differences, effectively setting a very high bar for future attempts.
Absolutely. That razor-thin margin prevented a precedent that might have fundamentally altered the balance between the executive and legislative branches, perhaps forever weakening the presidency. Following the acquittal, Stanton relinquished his office on May 26, effectively ending the standoff. And the Senate, as Johnson had promised in his maneuvering, confirmed John Schofield as the new Secretary of War. The storm had passed, but the presidency was severely weakened.
Beyond the relentless drama of Reconstruction and impeachment, Johnson's administration did have other facets, particularly in foreign policy. Secretary of State William H. Seward largely ran foreign policy, much as he had under Lincoln, demonstrating a remarkable continuity.
Seward was still pulling the strings there. Through quiet diplomacy, Seward successfully achieved the withdrawal of French troops from Mexico, who had installed a puppet emperor, Maximilian, thereby upholding the Monroe Doctrine and scoring a significant foreign policy victory for the United States.
A solid win on the foreign stage.
And of course, there was the famous Alaska Purchase in 1867. Seward, always thinking strategically, negotiated the purchase of Alaska from Russia for $7.2 million, which, to put it in modern terms, is equivalent to about $162 million today.
Seward's folly.
Right. He famously overcame initial Senate reluctance and public derision, where it was often sarcastically called Seward's folly or Seward's icebox. But as history proved, it was a strategic and territorial coup, adding vast natural resources and geopolitical advantage to the United States.
Good call, Seward. On the domestic front, Johnson also signed the Southern Homestead Act in 1866, believing it would assist poor whites in acquiring land, though in reality, few former slaves actually benefited from it due to various forms of discrimination and fraud.
Intent versus reality there. He also signed an 8-hour workday law for federal employees in 1868, which was seen as a progressive move at the time. However, the good intentions behind that law were immediately frustrated as wages were simultaneously cut by 20%, leading to mixed results and failing to deliver on its promise for many.
So kind of one step forward, one step back on that one. These well-intended reforms often struggled or were undermined in implementation, reflecting the chaotic environment of his presidency.
Totally. As his term drew to a close, Johnson sought the 1868 Democratic presidential nomination, hoping to win the office in his own right, but he ultimately failed to secure it, with Horatio Seymour ultimately chosen as the nominee.
No second term for Johnson.
Nope. His clashes with Congress continued right to the very end of his administration. He notably delayed the official reporting of the 14th Amendment's ratifications by the new Southern legislatures, clinging to his constitutional objections. But Congress, again, overrode his resistance, forcing him to officially announce its adoption in July 1868.
Still fighting it till the end. In his final months, Johnson, ever the defiant one, issued a controversial final amnesty on Christmas Day, 1868, covering all Confederates, including Jefferson Davis, much to the outrage of many in the North.
A final pardon for the Confederacy's leader. Wow.
He also controversially pardoned Dr. Samuel Mudge, who had been convicted of involvement in the Lincoln assassination conspiracy, and in a final symbolic act of defiance against his rival and successor, Ulysses S. Grant.
He skips the inauguration.
Johnson famously refused to attend Grant's inauguration ceremonies on March 4, 1869, leaving Washington hours before the incoming president took office, cementing his reputation as an outsider to the very end. So Andrew Johnson's presidency ended not with a bang, but with a symbolic snub, refusing to attend Grant's inauguration. After leaving the highest office, Johnson returned to Greenville, Tennessee, where, surprisingly, he was met with large public celebrations and a warm welcome from his constituents.
Back home, he was still somebody. But his private life remained deeply embittered by the tragic suicide of his son Robert in 1869, a personal blow amidst his public vindication.
That's terrible. Yet Johnson was not one to fade into the background. Driven by a relentless desire for vindication and revenge against his political enemies in Washington, he immediately sought to return to the national stage.
He couldn't stay away. He launched a Senate bid soon after returning home in 1869, losing by a single vote, a truly agonizing defeat. He also ran for a special congressional election in 1872, again without success. His determination was almost superhuman.
But the tailor from Tennessee was nothing if not persistent, utterly unyielding in his political ambition. In early 1875, with Reconstruction fading and African-American votes increasingly suppressed in the South, he campaigned intensely, appealing to the burgeoning farmers' grange movement and harnessing local resentments.
And incredibly, he wins. On the 54th ballot, by a single vote, he was finally elected to the U.S. Senate, making a remarkable political comeback.
54 ballot.
Insane. He famously remarked, "Thank God for the vindication," seeing it as a personal triumph over his detractors. To this day, he remains the only former president to ever serve in the Senate after leaving office.
just an unbelievable capstone to his career.
His comeback garnered national attention and added another unique chapter to his incredible life story. In his sole speech during his final Senate term, delivered on March 20, 1875, he lambasted President Grant for using federal troops in Louisiana's Reconstruction government, vehemently arguing against federal overreach.
Back to his old themes.
Exactly. He famously asked, "How far off is military despotism?" and concluded, "May God bless this people and God save the Constitution." A powerful, if brief, return to the national stage, echoing his lifelong constitutional convictions.
Sadly, that remarkable return was short-lived. Johnson died just a few months later, on July 31, 1875, at the age of 66, after suffering two strokes at his daughter's farm.
Gone just like that after fighting so hard to get back. Per his wishes, he was buried wrapped in an American flag with a copy of the U.S. Constitution placed under his head, a final, poignant symbol of his enduring, if often conflicted, patriotism. His burial ground later became the Andrew Johnson National Cemetery.
His historical reputation, though, that's another story entirely. It has undergone significant, almost kaleidoscopic shifts over time, largely mirroring broader changes in American society's understanding of race and Reconstruction.
Yeah, his legacy is really a moving target. Through the remainder of the 19th century and into the early 20th century, early historians often depicted him in contradictory ways, as an obstinate boor by Northerners, or conversely, as a flawed but sincere figure who genuinely tried to implement Lincoln's plans by Southern historians and figures like Woodrow Wilson.
And then the Dunning School.
Right, the Dunning School of historians, which dominated American historical thought for decades, even celebrated him as a humane, enlightened, and liberal statesman fighting scheming and unscrupulous radicals, a view now largely discredited for its racist underpinnings.
But the mid-20th century brought a dramatic and much-needed reevaluation. From the 1950s onward, with a growing focus on the African-American experience and the burgeoning civil rights movement, historical views shifted fundamentally.
The perspective changed completely. Johnson was increasingly seen as a successful saboteur of noble efforts to better the freedman's lot, and Reconstruction itself began to be viewed not as a period of misrule, but as a noble, though flawed, effort to integrate formerly enslaved people into American society and grant them their fundamental rights.
Today, the consensus among historians is quite different and largely solidified. Andrew Johnson is consistently ranked among the worst U.S. presidents.
Yeah, usually near the bottom, if not at the bottom. Historians widely cite his complete mishandling of Reconstruction policy, his bristling personality, and his mean and crude racism as factors that profoundly stunted his leadership during a time when clear, compassionate direction was desperately needed.
Though some do acknowledge his rise.
Right. Some acknowledge the miraculous quality of his rise from profound poverty and the immense, almost insurmountable difficulties of the era he had to confront. You can't deny the climb.
His lasting impact, then, is often tied directly to the maintenance of white supremacy and his deliberate undermining of Reconstruction, which, as our sources point out, would trouble the country for generations to come.
That's the really tragic part of his legacy. Ultimately, Johnson's presidency is a powerful, perhaps even tragic example of how individual prejudices, even when cloaked in constitutional arguments or appeals to states' rights, can profoundly derail national progress, leaving a legacy of racial division that echoed for over a century.
So we followed Andrew Johnson's incredible, improbable journey from a self-taught tailor born into abject poverty to the leader of a deeply divided nation during its most challenging period through an unprecedented impeachment trial and ultimately back to the Senate.
What a ride.
His story is a powerful testament to personal resilience and ambition, but it's also a profound cautionary tale about the perils of inflexible leadership and deeply ingrained prejudices, especially when confronting fundamental questions of human rights and national identity.
Indeed. From his unwavering unionism and his championing of the plebeian class, to his deeply controversial and destructive approach to Reconstruction and his unprecedented impeachment, Johnson's life was a series of defining struggles that continue to shape our understanding of American history. His unique personal history, his unyielding, stubborn resolve, and his deeply held convictions profoundly influenced the course of a nation trying to heal and redefine itself in the most turbulent of times.
Okay, so we've seen how Andrew Johnson's life was a testament to sheer willpower and personal ambition, but also how his choices, especially his steadfast resistance to racial equality during Reconstruction, deeply shaped a nation struggling to redefine itself after a devastating war.
Those choices had consequences for generations.
It raises an important question for you, the listener, to consider. How do leaders, even those with seemingly good intentions for their vision of the country, grapple with, or perhaps fundamentally fail to grapple with, the essential human rights of all citizens, especially in times of profound social and political transformation?
It's a tough question.
And what does that tell us about the responsibilities and challenges of leadership, even today, when faced with similar questions of inclusion and equity?